Welcome to another edition of Respond to Resilience. We're your hosts, David Dashinger and Dr. Stacey Raymond. And we want to remind everybody to like and subscribe. We are on YouTube, Respond to Resilience channel, on Facebook, Respond to Wellness Inc., and on BBS Radio TV. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Ray Connors, who's the retired chief of the State of Connecticut Animal Control Unit, about what animal control officers actually do, how they're genuinely first responders, and some looks behind the scenes at cases of animal abuse, animal attacks, and traumatic calls, and the incredible connection between animal abuse and serial killers right after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW EMTB. And we'd like to welcome Ray Connors to the show. Hey, Ray.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So let's read your bio here. It's quite impressive and extensive. Ray served in a 34-year career with the Connecticut Department of Agriculture State Animal Control Unit, and he was the chief from 2010 to 2018. He's the former president of the New England Federation of Humane Societies and the former president of the Connecticut Municipal Animal Control Association. Ray served on the Governor's Homeland Security and Emergency Management Advisory Committee and was a recipient of the Governor's Service Award. Ray is a former board member of the National Alliance of State Animal and Agricultural Emergency Programs and was a certified instructor with the Connecticut Police Academy from 1988 to 2018. He's the co-founder and instructor of the Connecticut Animal Control Officers Academy and a former member of Connecticut Hoarding Response Working Group. Welcome, Ray.
Thank you.
Hi, Ray. I thought I would start out by asking you, how did you get into this specialized profession? What was your background? What got you interested?
My background, I've been around animals all my life. I grew up actually on a dairy farm that was across the street from our house. When I was 11 years old, the first day we moved in, I went to that dairy farm and I never left. I worked on a lot of different farms and stuff in Western Connecticut, Southbury Training Schools, dairy, all that. My life kind of took a sidetrack for a while, and I got into working in nightclubs, working as a DJ in nightclubs, which I did for 25 years. But one day, I was living in Milford. I had a beautiful apartment on the beach and everything, living the life, and I was in my mid-20s, and you couldn't ask for anything better at that age. But I said to myself, I got to find a day job. So I opened a New Haven register, and there's a job for Connecticut Humane Society looking for a kennel person. I says, I like animals. So I took that job, and I actually loved it. And it paid horrible. I mean, it paid horrible money. But a year later, the test got announced for the state job as a state animal control officer. So I took that test, that exam, and I started at the bottom rung as an assistant regional animal control officer in the town of New Fairfield. And I worked my way up through the ranks for 34 years and did my last 8 years as chief of the unit.
Well, it's great. That's an interesting career path there.
Mm-hmm. Ray, somebody was watching over me. So.
Yeah, you got that guidance. When, you know, in my career, there was times when we would call animal control and we knew there was this guy who'd showed up in a van. He'd have like a snare or, you know, some other tools to handle things that animal situations that we couldn't handle. But what does an animal control officer actually do, and what are some of the hurdles of that profession?
Well, let's let's look at the image that animal control officers have. You go back to when we were kids and you look at the cartoons, and they had the dog catcher with the truck with, you know, and he's chasing them with a big net, chasing dogs with a big net. And then they put 30 dogs in the truck and the dogs escape and run off. And a lot of people still have that image of the dog catcher. And then it went from dog catcher that they started calling them dog wardens. But it was always, you know, somebody's brother-in-law needed a job in the town. Let him be the dog warden. He could be the dog catcher. So, and a lot of towns were like that right here in the state of Connecticut. And so over the years, the job has changed. It's changed so much. And when I started, I even noticed that the image, I wanted to change that image. I mean, we were dressed in uniforms, you know, we had trooper hats and everything. I mean, we looked the part. But I wanted to change that image to be more professional. And then they started being canine control officers. So now they had the officer title on the end. And they are animal control officers are officers of the court. They have the powers of arrest. They write infractions. They write summonses. It's in statute that they have the exact same powers as a constable, sheriff, or policeman in their jurisdiction. It's written right in the statute just like that. And a lot of towns never realize that. So the as when rabies hit in 1991 in the town of Richfield, actually, I remember it very well. It was in March of 1991. The whole job changed because now they're dealing with rabies. The animal control officers are dealing with rabies. So the statute got changed to include not just canines or dogs, but all animals.
It was, Ray, was the rabies in dogs or is it other animals as well?
It was the mid-Atlantic strain of raccoon rabies that came up from down south. And it actually got into Connecticut quicker than we thought it was going to. We were watching it come across in Pennsylvania, and we knew it was going to get to Connecticut, but we didn't know when. And just one day we got the call that, hey, there's this raccoon in Richfield. And it was funny. You could watch rabies spread across the state like a wave because we had a map that we would color each town in until it became statewide. And it's never gone away. It's still here.
Wow.
Yeah, it's still here. So anyway, their jobs are mostly you're caring for animals. You're picking up strays in the public safety for public safety reasons. You don't want disease spread. You don't want people injured. You don't want the animal injured. Animal control officers are doing animal cruelty investigations. Animal control officers are working their own budgets in for their shelters. They're running their shelters. A lot of them work by themselves. Animal control officers are like counselors, family counselors between neighbors, you know, because you got neighbors fight. Well, their dog's in my yard. Your dog's crapping in my yard. Well, you know, you kind of got to smooth things over in the neighborhood, you know?
Yeah. Right. Arbitrate those.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You have to be an arbitrator, you know, they have to be a mother to people or a father to people. They have to try and maintain a good public image. It's not an easy job, and they're not. A lot of them don't get the recognition. They're like the ugly stepchild of that nobody wants. You know, it's.
I was going to ask you about that. Why do you think that animal control officers don't seem to make the cut as, you know, being considered a first responder?
A lot of it goes back to the image of what I started with the dog catcher image, and that's not what it's about. I mean, a lot of these are uniformed people carrying sidearms, you know, wearing vests, you know, in response vehicles with emergency lights on them. A lot of them work directly with police departments, especially in the larger towns.
Right.
They work directly for the police department. The smaller towns, it's mostly, you know, through the selectman's office or something like that. I think actually there's one town that they work with the through the health department. They're assigned through the health department in Fairfield County. Go ahead.
Is there certain training that you go through so that then you say, okay, I have this credential as an animal control officer?
Okay, when I started in 1984, they gave you your infraction book, the keys to your van, and said, here you go, off you go. And this was at the state level.
Okay.
So even the local people weren't getting any training at all, none. The Connecticut Municipal Animal Control Officers Association started having annual conferences, training conferences. So at least once a year, they would get some training.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to get the National Animal Control Officers Academy brought to Connecticut. And so they could at least get some type of certification, even though it wasn't required. There was nothing required.
Huh.
Like a police officer has to go through their academy in that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So then I looked at writing up legislative language and mandating that animal control officers have training. They have to have a certain amount of training.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to get – it took 15 years, believe it or not, mm-hmm. to get it passed because there was always a fiscal note attached to it. So we were able to work that out. We worked with Connecticut Votes for Animals and through my department at the time. And we were able to get it passed where animal control officers now have to be certified. So,
okay.
And what happened was we would allow them to go through the national training. And then I would do another 8 hours so they would have local laws. And then after we decided, I met with a sergeant in New Britain PD. We decided to start our own academy. So what are we doing? We could do it for no cost to the municipalities or anybody. So we started our own academy, and it's 96 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're not required. They only required 60 hours. But we did 96 hour academy, and they still get their annual training. But you know, with COVID, it's kind of put any kind of conferences on hold for now, or any kind of training.
Sure. Right. But
through Justice Clearinghouse and other organizations, we're able to get them some training that way. And they have to have continuing education credits every year, too.
Okay.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back with Ray Connors talking about animal control and animal abuse and a bunch of other interesting topics right after this. Ray, something you were talking about earlier, I'm curious about this part of it. In terms of your job as an animal control officer, are you on call 24/7? How does that work? Like, you're responding, you know, at all hours?
Yeah, as a state officer, I was. And especially as chief, I really was. I didn't have a choice. You're on call 24/7. And, you know, it's part of the job. And I think every animal control officer is that, too. Unless they have an assistant that's on at night or something like that, but
right,
and you know, it's not unusual to get calls out.
Do you have mutual aid agreements? Like, how do you deal with situations where one officer is not enough?
There are some municipalities that do that. There was recently an incident in Litchfield County where there was a big fire that involved animals that were outside, and the owner of the animals evidently expired because of the fire, but they were able to get other municipalities to come in and assist. We've done that also with large animal cruelty investigations. By large, I mean multiple animals, where municipalities have come in to assist the state with transportation and catching animals and things like that. And even for housing animals, I mean, so many municipalities have reached out and helped other municipalities with housing, because, you know, their resources become overwhelmed. And even we've went ahead and reached out to Department of Emergency Management and had them help us, especially in cockfighting raids, where we needed places to house these and care for these animals, where they were able to go ahead and initiate ESF 11 and get the SART teams out to help us get things done.
So that leads me kind of to my next question of, elaborating a little bit more on what is it that you're dealing with as an animal control officer? We know about abusive animals. You mentioned the rabies. You talk about cockfighting. So just tell us a little bit more about what it is that you see out there as an animal control officer.
Well, I mean, things that I've seen personally, the hoarding things are real bad. You know, you get into these hoarding situations. We had one house that had 96 cats in the house and a German Shepherd. And woman lived there with her elderly mother. And, I mean, there was animal waste in places 3 feet deep in the house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it took us 5 days to get all the cats out of the house. And we had the fire department there helping us with decon. They allowed us to use their thermal imaging cameras on the last day, so we still found cats living within the walls.
Wow.
It's pretty bad. And hoarding is a whole different thing. I mean, that's why we started the hoarding working group, so that we would have team responses now, rather than animal control dealing with everything, and then, you know, you clean them out, and then 6 months later, they're right back to where you're supposed to be. With these hoarding response teams, everybody goes in: fire marshal's office, health department, social services. I mean, it works well. You go in as a team approach to solve the issue at once, you know, and get it taken care of. But it's not unusual for hoarders. This one case I'm talking about, I mean, she even took dead cats and kept them in her freezer because she couldn't part with them. They can't part with anything like that. And unfortunately, you know, there's a demographic that fits that. It's single women over the age of 50. And I've done a program multiple times about it. And, it's something you don't forget. And it's, you know, animal control officers, they walk away from that and it's still in your head. I mean, a lot of times they're using gallows humor to deal with it.
Right. Like any first responder. Right.
And, you know, I mean, I could remember one case. I was with Connecticut State Police Emergency Services. It was snowing out. And we found dead animals in a house, a dead Rottweiler laying on the floor. It was disgusting. But 10 o'clock at night, we're eating cheeseburgers off the trunk of the trooper's car in the snow. And we just start laughing at each other because it's so surreal that what you're dealing with.
Right.
That it's the only thing you have, you know. But you carry that with you. It stays with you. You know, you never forget that. It's always inside you. It's always with you. You know, and then the animal cruelty cases that you see with the starving animals. It goes a lot of times. I've been on animal cruelty cases where there's children involved. Not only they're not feeding their animals, they're not feeding their children. You know, you look in the cabinets on a search warrant and there's just no food in the house for anybody.
Yeah, right.
You know, and your heart goes out to them. I mean, you hate to make their life more miserable than it already is with the problems they're having. But, you know, then again, I have a job to do. I have to take care of those animals. We have to make sure those kids are getting taken care of.
Right.
And then, you know, hopefully the court will get them into the right direction where they get the help they need. It's a tough thing, but you live with that, and to see kids like that, and cases where a gentleman was just urinating in bottles and defecating in bottles, living with his handicapped 12-year-old daughter, and sexually abusing his 12-year-old daughter, and he left the animals in this house and walked away. And we go in there and we find a Rottweiler dead in front of the refrigerator. And you open the refrigerator door and all the dog food is in the refrigerator. So the dog died in front of just trying to get the food in that fridge.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's the stuff that stays with you. And knowing that this gentleman, what he was doing to his daughter,
right,
is also staying with you. And these are the kind of people the animal control officers deal with, the exact same people that police officers deal with.
Sure. Right.
And that's what's got to be realized, is that, you know, it's not just all playing with puppies in the dog pound, you know, because that's 5% of the job.
Sure.
The rest of it is enforcement and investigative work.
And what stands out is clearly there's you step into situations where there's mental illness.
Oh, God, yes. Constantly.
So these are sort of like crisis intervention calls.
Yeah.
Fairfield County Trauma Response Team is a nonprofit alliance of mental health professionals dedicated to helping first responders heal from trauma, tragedy, and stress. We help as they manage community crises and the everyday demands of ensuring public health and safety. Established in 2011, FCTRT was formed in response to a call for emotional help from the Stamford Fire Department after a traumatic fatal fire. Less than a year later, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting occurred, and members again served the first responder community. Most recently, COVID-19 created a need for our support. We provide free educational presentations, pro bono sessions to deal with community disasters, and an extensive referral service to trauma-informed psychotherapists. If you're a responder in Fairfield County and need help dealing with duty-related stress, please reach out to us so you can continue to do the job you love. Visit our website at fctrt.org or find us on Instagram at Fairfield County TRT.
So, Ray, how do you, you know, you're seeing a side of humanity that's extremely difficult to see. It's painful. How do you cope with that as an animal control officer? Or what do you counsel your officers? What did you counsel them to do when they come off of a particularly difficult call?
Yeah, well, you know, everybody has EAP, employee assistance programs, and mm-hmm. But they, without the background of them knowing exactly what the animal control officer is going through, it's so generalized that they don't truly get the help that they need. A lot of times it was just sitting around talking about it with your peers. And
sure.
You know, it was the best you could do. A lot of them just took it home with them. You know, a lot of animal control officers I know ended up, you know, they're on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication to try and just cope.
Yeah.
And it's a tough thing. I mean, even when you go out and you do dog bite investigations, you see horrible, horrible injuries on people. You mm-hmm. see death.
Sure.
Yeah. 3-month-old infant dead from mm-hmm. a dog attack.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
that stays with you the rest of your life.
Would you say there's a high amount of burnout?
Yeah, you see it quickly. Either they stay in forever like I did, or they just say, this is not for me. And I've had people that work under me that they last a week and they said, this isn't for me. Because, you know, they see a dog hit by a car or something and, you know, I can't deal with this. Or euthanasias. That's another whole story is, you know, here you are helping animals. But then there's an animal overpopulation or a dog is aggressive or what have you, and it's not good to put it into another home.
Mm.
You have to euthanize that animal. Here's an animal you've been taking care of, and now you have to take it to the veterinarian and have it euthanized.
Mm.
You know, so now you're dealing with that guilt, plus it just eats away at your soul. It really does.
Wow.
Wow.
No doubt. Let's take another quick break. We'll come back, talk more about the psychological aspects of being an animal control officer and a lot more right after this. And we're back, Responder Resilience, with Dr. Stacy Raymond and Ray Connors, who's a retired animal control officer, state of Connecticut. We were just talking about some of the psychological aspects that you encounter as an animal control officer. What do we need to know about animal abuse? What are the things that the public doesn't see that are going on that would help people to better understand abuse of animals, the warning signs when this is going on? Maybe they may see something going on, but they don't quite know what to do with that information. What do you recommend?
Well, if somebody suspects any type of animal abuse, they should call their animal control officer in their town or the police department in their town. And have it looked into. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's behind closed doors, like a hoarding situation. You wouldn't know about it until there's such an odor emanating that, you know, they're an issue. The one I was talking about previously with the 96 cats, that was a welfare check that a trooper went on somebody hadn't heard from an aunt that lived in the house.
Right.
And the trooper went there and saw the conditions. As soon as she opened the door, he could smell the conditions.
Right.
And that's what started that ball rolling. A lot of times with larger animals like horses and livestock, it's people just see them out in the field and say, geez, those animals are skinny or they have no food, they have no shelter. Mm-hmm. And that usually starts the ball rolling with that. When we get into felony animal cruelty stuff, like animal fighting, usually it's a tip at the last minute. It's not anything that you know about ahead of time. And especially cockfighting, which is quite prevalent in the state of Connecticut, which you wouldn't think. But
no, I wouldn't think that.
Yeah. But it's a lot of it's a cultural thing where it's legal, you know, and because of the demographics that are changing within the state, the culture's coming with it. It is illegal. It's a felony for everybody involved in the state of Connecticut. Huh. And it shows up in the strangest places. In a church hall was rented out. 1 o'clock in the morning, we got the call for that one. And it's usually somebody that lost all their money and is mad, so they go ahead and call the police department.
So they call in the PD, and then the PD's asking you to respond with
right.
them?
Okay. Right. Yeah. To handle animals. Mm-hmm. And, or there's one case up in the middle of nowhere in the northwest part of the state that was a trooper went there on a welfare check. And again, these welfare checks, they really help out a lot. And they found a whole, basically a boarding facility for cockfighters where they could keep their birds. Wow. And it was multi-state. Not only does animal control get involved, but a lot of times now the state police and their major crime units are working hand in hand with other state agencies and local agencies on cases like this now, because they know that there's other things involved, whether there's firearms involved, there may be drugs involved, especially in dog fighting. So, animal control is all a part of this, and they're working side by side with police officers. Yeah.
Ray, so when you go into a situation and the animals have to be removed, where do you put them? Like, who cares? Who cares for them? Who pays for their medical bills, vet bills?
Well, if it's a municipality, the municipality is on the hook for the vet bills and stuff. And there's actually a law that got passed where we have an animal abuse recovery account with the state.
Okay. Right.
And the town could actually tap some of that money to help get some of the costs back, where the court orders the person to pay, reimburse the municipalities.
Okay. Right. Right.
And as far as housing, some towns don't even have a shelter, animal shelter. So they rely on outlying other larger animal control units to help them house cats, dogs, things like that. Large animals, the state has a barn at Niantic at York Correctional, and female inmates work there to help care for larger animals, whether it's mostly livestock, goats, horses, cattle, things like that.
Yeah. Okay.
That's great. So on the psychological aspect, why do people hurt animals in the first place? And are there links between child abuse and animal abuse and even serial killers or people that are incarcerated?
Most serial killers abused animals prior at some time in their life, mm-hmm. whether they were a child or what have you. And it starts young. It's always the innocent thing. What can they power over on something innocent? So it starts with animals. It may go to children. It may go to domestic partners. It may be for retribution for something. Oh, you're leaving me. You know, you're breaking up with me. We're getting divorced or whatever. There was a gentleman that took his wife's puppies or his girlfriend's puppies and slit all their throats. It's just violent acts. And there is a link between animal abuse and child abuse. And we had some outstanding state representatives at the time that in working with the Department of Children and Families, we were able to get a law passed where there's now cross-reporting in the state of Connecticut for child abuse and animal abuse. And what that means is if DCF goes out on a child abuse call and there's an animal there that they have concerns about, they report that to the Department of Agriculture. And the Department of Agriculture will then notify a municipality to go out and take a look and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it works the other way where every animal cruelty complaint gets reported to the Department of Agriculture on a form. Mm-hmm. That form is then forwarded to DCF, and DCF crosses that information with anything that they may be working on that will red flag it, and then they would get involved that way.
Wow.
So if there's animal abuse in the house and children, then they would go out and take a look and make sure the kids are all right.
Right.
To avoid things that I've seen in the past, you know, the empty food cabinets and things like that.
Sure.
Yep. Let's take one more break. We'll be back with Ray Connors, Dr. Stacey Raymond, talking about animal control and animal abuse right after this. And we're back with Ray Connors, who is a retired state of Connecticut animal control officer, and Dr. Stacey Raymond. Stacey, why don't you go ahead and ask the next question?
So, Ray, can you tell us about the unfortunate, common occurrence of having either to put down an aggressive animal or separate that animal from its owner because it's not being taken care of? How do you deal with the stress of that?
Well, you got to look at it from the point of the animal. Nobody, especially the way animals are taken care of now, it's a lot different than when I was a kid where, you know, everybody had their dog basically tied to a doghouse in the backyard. now they're part of the family. They're in the house. They basically control the house. I know my dog does.
Yeah.
It's changed, and nobody likes to break up a family like that. Mm-hmm. But public safety is the number one thing that animal control mm-hmm. officers mm-hmm. do.
Right.
So if there's an animal that is aggressive towards people, mm-hmm. there's things in statute that are put in place to protect the public, mm-hmm. whether it's putting a restraint order on a dog or a disposal order on a dog. Huh. And the people have the right to their due process through hearing process and through courts if they so elect. But I've always said this, and when I taught to the academy, I always said this, it's harder to take their animals away than their children. Mm-hmm. They would give up their children before they'll give up their pets. and it's always been that way. It's it's a very hard thing to deal with. There's a lot of emotion involved.
Sure.
And again, you got to be the arbitrator and get in right. there and try to tell them what's right. I mean, so many cases have ended up in the media, and especially in this in the social media, you know, that they start gathering steam like a snowball going downhill.
Right.
And then there's nationwide responses. I can't tell you how many emails, how many letters I've received from people all over the world to say this certain dog that basically mauled three people. And,
wow.
You know, you got to do, you just got to keep in your head that it's public safety, public safety, public safety. With animal cruelty complaints, you got to do what's best for the animal. You know, get it out of that situation. There's things in statute that allow us to go into court, allow animal control and municipalities to go into court and basically sue in civil court for possession of the animal, or they have to post a bond to help offset the cost of the care of the animal while it's in custody.
Okay.
Wow. So shifting gears a little bit on the lighter side, can you talk about a call that was particularly funny or heartwarming?
The funniest one is I went to Stacy's laughing. I went to a livestock damage in New Britain at a convent. They had some horses. They had some ponies there. So I go in and having gone to a Catholic school, I know it. I remember what nuns were like in the 60s. So I still had that fear in the back of my head. Well, I go in and Mother Superior comes out, and I told her while I was there, and she says, I says, can you show me where this has happened? You know, and I want to see the animals. So she says, sure, we'll go out. Well, there's a car parked right in front of the convent. She opens the door, gets in the car. I says, do you want to drive, sister? She goes, no, you drive. So I get in the driver's side of the car. And I says, do you have the keys? And she says, isn't this your car? I says, no, it's not my car. So I was stealing a car with a nun. So
that's good.
I never lived that one down. When I went back and told that story, that was actually one of the good ones. And then, you know, we were talking about gallows humor. I remember going to a call where we had to take animals out of the house before EMS could remove the body from the house. This woman died in her house. And there was beer cans everywhere. I mean, they were deep, 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 deep. So we're walking through the house and we're kicking cans, just trying to get our footing without breaking our necks. All of a sudden, me and the officer I was with, the coworker, we're standing on something solid and we kick the cans off to the side. We're standing on top of the coffee table. That's how deep the cans
wow.
are. So he looked around the room and he says, I wonder where she threw the first can. So it kind of broke up the, you know, dealing with the dead body smell and,
right.
and you know, the dogs were just flea infested. And and then you got to try and find a family member because dogs are personal property or private personal property to, you know, get permission to take care of the animals and do what had to be done. And then in that case, the next of kin was in Chicago. And so it took us a while to locate somebody. But, you know, animal control officers, they're the first ones in on a lot of these cases, you know, whether it's that or I remember one officer had to go to a guy that hung himself in a tree and his dog was protecting him at the bottom. That officer had to go in and remove that vicious dog while this guy's hanging from the tree. And she never got that image out of her head. Ever.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right. And you mentioned you wear vests as well.
Not everybody. Very, very few had vests. My department did not have vests. We did not have vests. We did not have sidearms.
Wow. Well, in your long, illustrious career, was there ever a moment where someone took you aside or wrote you a letter or called you up and thanked you for what you did? Do you ever get that kind of positive feedback from the public?
I did. And I actually enjoyed going out to schools and stuff and talking to the kids in school. Mm-hmm. Right here in my town, we have an agricultural high school. that is actually a school I went to that, you know, I always enjoy going in and talking to the classes, even teaching at the academy. You know, I had police cadets come up and thank me because they had no idea what the job really entailed. Mm-hmm. And actually, a lot of them, I know a lot of police officers now that when they retire from the PD, they go on to be animal control officers. Because they just like the job. They like dealing with the animals. And we're seeing that more and more where, you know, law enforcement officers are becoming animal control officers. But, I've gotten letters of thanks and donations made in my name to animal organizations and things. It's a nice thing to see once in a while. Sure. It really makes a big difference.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask you about compassion fatigue. Is it something that animal control officers struggle with? And if so, what is it? What does that look like? And so what's your observation of that?
Compassion fatigue, I mean, I think anybody that's a first responder deals with it. Animal control officers kind of get it twofold because here you are, you're day after day after day, you're seeing animals that are just, you know, either running stray or animals that are abused, and it just stays with you. And unfortunately, a lot of animal control officers just keep it inside. I did that. And my wife will attest to the fact that I came home and she would have the animal planted on and I'd say, you got to shut that off. I can't. I mean, I can't watch this. And you try and remember the good things and that you're doing good, you know, why, what your job is for. But that's why there's a high burnout rate, too, because people just can't handle that. Constantly eating away at your soul, which it does. It does. And sure. I got to the point in 34 years, I got to the point and just one day I says, I can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was it for me.
Right.
Because I knew it was time to go. There was, you always look for the good stories. And I wasn't going to mention it, but we did have a horse that came from an animal cruelty complaint where we ended up taking multiple horses from this place. And ended up in our facility in Niantic. And the horse was in such horrible shape. Couldn't walk. Couldn't breathe. It was just horrible, horrible shape. And the veterinarian we were working with, Dr. Thor Hippa, you know, we ended up putting two of the horses down already that we took from there. And we looked at this one horse and we just said, you know, this guy's got will. Let's just give him a chance, see what he does. So, you know, we put him on medication for his breathing, got his feet as best as we could. Mm-hmm. And this really super woman came and adopted this horse. And she did her background on the horse and found out that he was a famous barrel racing horse out of Montana. And she did a documentary on this horse that was sold to Amazon Prime called His Name is Midnight. Mm-hmm. Mm. And I was talking to David before this show about this. And the first time I saw the movie was at the New Jersey Film Festival in Atlantic City. And I think I unloaded 32 years at the time of emotion watching that movie.
Sure.
Because all I did is, and I'm not ashamed to admit this, all I did is cry through that entire movie. It's just everything just came out of me at once. And it's stories like that and that really, really touch you inside that you did something good and this horse went on to have a fabulous life after, spoiled beyond belief.
Yeah. And it's we did watch that movie. I can't recommend it enough. It's on Tubi now. But it really is a story of and seeing the abuse of this animal. Then them discovering what his lineage was, which was quite impressive, and then seeing him rehabilitated. It's just an incredible transformation from this gaunt, very hungry,
injured.
Starving, injured horse who can barely walk, and you realize that this horse had a career as an athlete, an elite athlete, and then he had the resilience to bounce back. So thanks to you and the other animal control officers and the people that took care of him. So it's a great story. I would recommend it. Anybody
yeah,
wants
it's
to
a,
see it.
It really captures all of what the best of animal control and how you can take an animal and turn its life around. And it's only 28 minutes long too. So it's easy. It doesn't take a long time to watch. And it's absolutely worth viewing.
And that, and you know, animal control officers have stories like that every day where they turn the life of an animal around.
Right.
You know, they, but it's unrecognized. And we were just fortunate enough to have this one spotlighted for us.
Yes.
You know, the stars aligned for this horse. But every animal control officer has a story like that.
Great. Well, Ray, as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share that we didn't cover?
No, I just hope that animal control officers continue to evolve the way they have in the last 36 years to continue to be the professionals that they are and to continue to get their education, the continuing education, and to always have that thirst to learn more and more and more. Even though I'm retired, I still have that thirst to learn more and more and more. So I just hope that they get the respect they deserve. And if they feel that they need to talk to anybody, to reach out to somebody that they would understand and to get the assistance that they need so that they can continue on with the job that they do.
Stacy, any final words?
Yeah, I just want to thank you, Ray, for enlightening us as to like the what you deal with as a animal control officer. And it's very clear to me, and I'm sure to David as well, how you fit in as a first responder. It's very clear now.
Yeah.
Thank you for educating us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
We appreciate, Ray, everything you've done, and you've obviously done a lot to advance the cause for animal control officers in the state of Connecticut, so kudos for that.
Thank you.
Please like and subscribe, Respond to Resilience channel on YouTube. We're also on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and on bbsradio.com. Till the next episode, stay safe, be nice to yourself.